This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to have Hugh Masekela with us. As you talk about all of these challenges, I keep thinking I'm talking to Hugh Masekela, who has brought the music of the world to the world with a lot of other people. You didn't do it alone, but this sense of first you got to do it. You don't sit only and talk about it. You don't only sit and think about it. You don't just have a drink over it. The action part of what you have done seems to me to be critical. You did pick up a horn. Now, it took Father Huddleston to help you do, and you really did have lots of help along the way. You are a self-made person who had a lot of help getting made. But this sense of, okay, I understand there's a problem, now I need to do something. Seems to me that that horn in hand, as Hugh Masekela went out into the world, was very important.
Well, you know, it's really funny because in 1963, after Miriam Makeba had been a childhood friend, Huddleston got me out of South Africa to the Guildhall School of Music.
In London.
In London. And Miriam Makeba was realizing the dreams that we dreamt together. She'd also been a girlfriend of mine, and we're very close. And
she'd already been a big star in South Africa.
Very big. She was the biggest star. And then when she came to the States, she just kept writing to me to say, I can't believe it, but I'm hanging out with Duke Ellington and Mahalia Jackson and Leontine Price and you gotta come here. And so finally, like, when I was in England, she brought me to America, bought me my fresh trumpet and, like, sent me to school, introduced me to Belafonte and asked him to help me. And they both sent me to school. And I met Louis Armstrong, then they introduced me to Dizzy and Miles, and you name them. You know, all of a sudden I was in this company. So they put that first challenge there, and I think I might have been copping out because in 1963 I decided, well, I've learned enough, I should go back home. That's when Belafonte set me down. And Miriam Makeba, the year before, that very year, had addressed the United Nations and told them for the first time, told the world what was happening really in South Africa. And that was a very big sacrifice at the time of her career was like really at its pinnacle. And the Western world was really like South Africa's biggest ally at that time. So they didn't take to it really kindly because South Africa was saying, you got to get rid of that, woman. And they finally, of course, got, she left in 1967, went to live in Guinea. But she sacrificed so much to conscientize the world about not only the sufferings of people in South Africa, but in Africa and even in America. And Belafonte at the time was like the greatest fundraiser for the civil rights movement. When I wanted to leave, he said to me, Hugh, they're going to kill you in South Africa. With your mouth, they're going to kill you. Why don't you stay here, think about staying here, and make a name for yourself so that when you talk about your country, people will listen. So I was mentored and inspired by unselfish people. And Louis Armstrong at the time was the American goodwill ambassador. He used to go everywhere. And he actually, when I arrived here and they bombed those children in Alabama, he actually called ICE Now and said, I can't be a goodwill ambassador for you anymore when my people are being bombed, especially my children. And those things really, really stuck with me. And I couldn't get into the conspicuous consumption kind of success. Have you seen my car? Have you seen my house kind of thing? And I think that very centered me to always remember that there are people suffering where I come from, and those are the people I source from.
I was really surprised as I was reading the story you tell so elegantly and still grazing. I was surprised how connected African Americans and Americans were personally, and how the music just kind of bounced back and forth. And this sense of the American, African Americans struggling to be free, and the Africans struggling to be free, and the music that fed each other, this sense of connection, I hadn't I hadn't had. That's very powerful, and I hadn't seen it quite that way before. Did it always feel connected? As a little kid in Africa, you're learning American jazz. America then picks out South African music. This back and forth, the connection seemed really strong.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I first listened to the gramophone, I was listening to Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong and Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald and Count Basie and Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young. And I mean, these were the records besides the South African records. And I was singing a tisket to tusket, you know.
I didn't know what
I was. Yeah, I didn't know what I was singing about. But they also used to show those sepia shots, you know, with like, and there were two movies, Cabin in the Sky and Stormy Weather, that we knew by heart. You couldn't get into the movies. Somehow, and even today in Africa, people still, you know, people who don't know really still think that African Americans are the African people who live the best life. So you aspire towards theirs. So, and then another thing is that when we're industrialized and we're to move from our rural places into the cities, the only people you could emulate is how do other Africans who have been exposed to this live. So as a result, we wanted to sing like them, dance like them, tap dance like them, walk like them, talk like them, and play like them, you know. And
yet they're derivative of you.
Exactly, you know. That, but we used to call, in jazz, and like when we were into threads, that like the people... We used to call South Africa, the United States, home. Dilala, you know, it is in the slang, you know, it was called Dilala. So when I was leaving, my friends who knew I was leaving, like, just looked at me, and some of them with tears in their eyes, like, you're going home. You know, you really go
to America,
and then when I came to the States, even though I was well read and educated, I still thought that if I walked down 125th Street, I'd run into like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald doing their Saturday morning shopping. You know,
well, you did, but not everybody
and
did.
Yeah, but when you drive from Kennedy, which is Idlewild, then into New York, you drive through Harlem, and I kept asking. You know, I kept, even when like Mburumba Karina picked me up from the terminal and we're driving, I kept saying, are we in New York? Is this, you know, because I couldn't believe. And, you know, New York is also very photogenic when you see it in the movies. But when you look at the videos today that, you know, on MTV of like African-American life, you think that like, damn, these kids live well, you know. And yet, in the 30 years that I lived here, I've never, to a certain extent, with apartheid, it was very clear. You know, it was very clear and it was legislated. But I didn't leave Manhattan for 1.5 years. I didn't even go to Brooklyn, because I realized that I was in dangerous territory, you know, because people were getting lynched. And in South Africa, you avoided only the police mostly. But here, you didn't know who was going to lynch you. Now, in 1969, I went to play in West Virginia, and I had like a big hit. Then it was really snowing. John Sebastian opened the show, we opened for him. But they were told that we couldn't live in, we couldn't, no hotel would take us in that town, in Staunton, Virginia. So we had to go 50 miles into the mountains. And it was snowing like hell. It took us 4 hours to get there. And then we were sitting in a Chinese restaurant, because they said that was the safest place to go. And there was nobody. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And it was myself and my girlfriend and my saxophone player, and we ordered some food. And then about 12 bikers came in. And this one girl was chewing gum, said, damn, there was nobody in the place. And place is so full, ain't nowhere to sit in this place. And the Chinaman came, you know, the owner came and said, I think you must take away. And we said, okay, and we took the ticket because we knew that if we didn't leave then, you know, that was it. So this was 1969 already, and that could never have happened to me in South Africa, even at that time.
This is going to take a minute. Jerry Adams sat where you were sitting, the president of Sinn Féin, and pointed out that in Atlanta, he'd just come from a meeting with President Carter, and he said, Atlanta, it may be the only city in the world where that has two Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winners from here, Dr. King and President Carter. And I've sort of grown up thinking that the world, particularly the oppressed world, looked to Dr. King to provide leadership, to provide moral inspiration, to provide hope. And in listening to Jerry Adams, and then 2 days later, talking to Barney Pityana, head of UNISA, former freedom fighter, it occurred to me that the mantle may have passed, that people no longer look to this country, that perhaps Nelson Mandela and perhaps Jerry Adams and perhaps South Africa has taken the mantle of leadership in terms of doing and creating the kinds of institutions necessary for us to survive in this world.
Let's let Hugh Masekela respond to that when we return in just a moment on the Paula Gordon Show. Please be with us.